Cornwall's 10th Annual Pride Parade and Festival is almost here. Join us on July 19th at Lamoureux Park in Cornwall for our free Pride Festival featuring live entertainment, a barbecue and beer tent, bouncy castles, face paint, carnival games, and more. To learn more about the festival or register for the parade, visit diversitycornwall.ca. Diversity Cornwall would like to acknowledge the generous support of FedDev Ontario in making this event possible.
If you are tired of the algorithm-based music age we are in and looking for unique, boundary-pushing new sounds, join me, Luke, and oftentimes friends on The Grove every Tuesday at 3. We will listen to and discuss music from electronic to alternative. See you there.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
I'm Deanna Boutou, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Dalia Al-Ahmad. And today we're going to be talking about what it has been like for the past couple of weeks living under Israel's attack on Iran. So the funny thing is that so many people were very concerned about what it's like for people like me living in 48, because these were the cities that were the targets. And yet this is where you see that caught as Palestinians, we're the ones who end up being caught in this war, in this game that Israel is playing. So the first thing is that, you know, Israel's always looking to find some type of technological solution to what is essentially a political problem. And so living inside Haifa, any building that was built after 1990 has to have a protected room, a protected space. And this is a room that is effectively made out of concrete. And so it gives you this false sense of security of having a quote-unquote bomb shelter inside of your house. But there are also public shelters, but these public shelters are primarily located in Jewish Israeli towns. So, for example, for me living in Haifa, because the Palestinian population is so small, there are public shelters that I have access to in the city. There's quite a number of them. They're practically in every neighborhood. But that being said, that isn't to say that Palestinians who are citizens have access to shelters at all. The vast majority of Palestinian cities and towns actually don't have shelters. So when you look at there's been a study that was done back in 2018 that looked at 71 localities. And of those 71 localities, only 11 of them had public shelters, with a total of 29 shelters. That's it. And so when you're looking at where it is that Palestinians lie, it's we're the ones who end up being caught in the crossfire of this war games that the Israelis play. So again, they're always looking for technological solutions for what is a political issue. So they will do things like create these bomb shelters, or they will you have an app on your phone that tells you, that warns you that you should be going to your protected space, or you get a national siren that tells you that you should be going into the bomb shelter. We have water here, we have electricity, we have fuel, we have internet, we have phone, we have all of those things. And so all of those amenities are available. And of course, they have this Iron Dome system, which they claim to be a system that works. But on so many occasions, we've seen that people have actually been injured, and some of them killed, as a result of the shrapnel that comes down from the Iron Dome system. And so you look at this technology that the Israelis have created, and they've created this false sense of security that you can, on the one hand, be enjoying yourself on the beach in Tel Aviv and not have to worry about anything because you have an app, you have a phone, you have a siren, you have your water, you have your fuel, you have everything. You have Iron Dome, and so you don't actually have to deal with the politics of it. And then in Palestinian communities, you don't have any of those things. And yet, when you look at the statistics, Elia, it was really interesting for me to look at the statistics of who was supporting this war and who wasn't in support of this war. It was so telling that 81% of Israelis actually support the attack on Iran. And then 9.6% of Jewish Israelis support the attack on Iran, but say that the timing isn't right. So you're talking about over 90% of Jewish Israelis supporting this attack on Iran. It doesn't at all make sense. And yet, when you look at the statistics among the Palestinian community, it's practically the opposite. So we're the ones who are caught in this crossfire. We're the ones who don't have this protection. We're the ones who don't believe in this war. And we're the ones who recognize that you can't just technology your way out of what's essentially a political problem. And there's another thing that I think is really important to keep in mind, which is in the South, in the Nakba, they don't even have any of this stuff. So they don't have the Iron Dome. They don't have the apps. They don't have sirens, because the communities there live in unrecognized villages. And because they're in unrecognized villages, the Israelis don't provide any of those systems. So can you imagine that there'd be Jewish Israelis living in an unrecognized town? So you can see how the combination of racism and the combination of apartheid just comes together, particularly when it came to this war, and how it is that you as a Palestinian in the West Bank, me as a Palestinian in 48, how we are the ones who are the most opposed to this. And yet you can see the ways in which Israel ends up using and guiding and carrying out war without ever us being able to have our say in this. And, you know, as people were messaging me and calling me and asking me about what it was like here, I just kept thinking about Gaza. You and I have talked about this many times, that Gaza doesn't have any of this. They're people who, they don't have an app, they don't have the siren. They've been living under these bombs for 630 days. They don't have fuel, they don't have food, they don't have water, they don't have electricity, they don't even have hospitals any longer. And it's just been day after day after day after day. And so much of what this attack on Iran was about was to cover up the genocide. And during these 12 days, we saw that Israel used the opportunity to kill 850 Palestinians in Gaza. And so it leaves you with this sense of you know, feeling that all of this was about covering up their genocide in Gaza and repositioning Netanyahu so that he can continue to do what he's been doing without really anybody saying anything.
That brings a question to my mind, as you mentioned, with everything that you mentioned, and specifically when talking about the Iron Dome and this system that is specifically designed to protect civilians. It also classifies large Palestinian communities as open areas, meaning that this Iron Dome system may ignore rockets aimed at those areas. Right. The most prominent of these areas are the Bedouin communities in the Negev region in southern occupied Palestine, as you mentioned. This brings a question to my mind. How do Palestinian communities generally feel about all of this when we talk about Arab communities that are classified as open areas or when we talk about their lack of access to public shelters, for example?
Well, it's kind of terrifying. So first is that one of the things that I forgot to mention was that even when there are public shelters, like even if you're in a city where there is a public shelter, there have been so many documented cases where people were being kicked out of those public shelters are not being allowed in. So, for example, there was a woman here at Haifa who was wearing hijab, who was kicked out of a public shelter because that public shelter is in an Orthodox area, so they wouldn't let her in. And there have been many, many, many documented cases in the Tel Aviv area where Palestinian men were not allowed in, or where Thai workers were not allowed in, or where Indian tourists were not allowed in, or where Sudanese were not allowed in. Because again, the country is a very, very, very racist country. So in the Nakba, where we saw that there were no shelters whatsoever, yeah, people just ended up staying at home because there aren't any of these amenities that are being provided, etc. But again, it goes back to this idea that Israel's always thinking that it can just technology its way out of everything, and it can't. But in its process of technology its way out of all of this, that technology is really only focused on Jewish Israelis. And that's why you see so many of the such high numbers of Jewish Israelis end up supporting this idea of war, of unethical, illegal wars, because they think that they're safe. They think that they are protected. They think that you can just have a system where you could just beat up on everybody in the region and they can continue to have their little parties on the beach. So it's a bizarre way of thinking, but that's largely because this is the way that the world has allowed them to think. And for Palestinian communities, it's really quite terrifying. So, for example, as I said, I'm living in Haifa. I'm living in a house that was built after 1990, but my family home is located in Nazareth. It was a house that was built after the Nakba in 1953. We were originally from the Palestinian town of El Mjadel. That town was ethnically cleansed in 1948. And my father's family ended up being internally displaced just a few kilometers away to the city of Nazareth. They ended up building a house in the 1950s. Now, because that house was built in the 1950s, it of course doesn't have a shelter. And there's so many houses in Nazareth that don't have these shelters. And so you end up seeing that these that people end up huddling together. They are told that they should be staying in underneath their stairs and so on. But my house doesn't have stairs. So you're really just, again, left into the open. And once again, these are decisions that are being made by the state to go after, illegally go after Iran, to go on and carry out these unethical, illegal wars. And it's the Palestinian community that ends up paying the price, whether that community is Palestinians in the West Bank, whether it's Palestinians who are in 48, and of course, it's Palestinians in Gaza, because this attack on Iran was entirely designed to divert attention from the genocide in Gaza.
And then this is also when we're talking about the shelters or the existence of shelters. I also want to mention, what about the rescue services, for example? Because some of the testimonies from 48 lands would say that they do not really feel safe, specifically in times of a conflict like this or like the past 2 weeks that we've been through, for example. And they mentioned the rescue services, for example, like even a simple thing as ambulances and defense response, they are very slow in Palestinian Arab areas when compared to other neighborhoods. Can you walk us through what that actually looks like on the ground?
Oh, yeah. It's not just the emergency services, it's hospitals as well. So, you know, we can take a look, for example, at the city of Nazareth. Nazareth is the largest Palestinian city. It's got about 80,000 Palestinians in it. And the hospitals that exist there all predate the state. Israel hasn't created any hospitals in any Palestinian cities since 1948, none. All of the hospitals that exist predate the state. And any hospital that has been created after the establishment of the state of Israel is in a Jewish Israeli town. So that means that if you get injured, you're going to have to be driven several kilometers to be able to get to the nearest hospital, the nearest emergency service, just to be able to get treatment. These are the things that you and I have talked about, or at least we've talked about on the podcast before, is how there is apartheid in the medical system, how Israel has never done anything to change that apartheid reality. It's all about ensuring and making clear that Palestinians are forever going to live under this apartheid rule. And simple things, again, like not having hospitals. I want to give you an example. When one of the missiles that fell on a Palestinian town of Tabra, and it killed four Palestinians in this town. In the town of Tabra, it's got 37,000 Palestinians. No public shelters, not a single one. The nearest Israeli town is called Mitzpeh Aviv. It's got a population of 1,100, and it has 13 public shelters. Incidentally, as the missile was coming down, there was a video that was taken of the people of Mitzpeh Aviv cheering on and saying, "Onto the village, onto the village, hit it, hit the village," meaning hit Tabra. And then they started chanting a very famous chant of "May your village burn." And indeed, it did hit Tabra. And these four women ended up dying. Now, not only was it difficult for them to get the first responders to get to Tabra, but to get from Tabra to then get to a hospital is very far. So this is the whole point, is that everything is designed in a way that it's all about having a system of apartheid. And there's also another element to it, Dalia, which is the censorship. A lot of what was happening was censored. We had no idea what was hit. We had no idea how hard it was hit. Journalists were routinely told that these were closed military zones. Journalists were routinely roughed up by people who were representing the state, but also by citizens as well. And so the combination of the lack of first responders, the inability of these first responders to get to a nearby hospital, because hospitals are very far away in these from these Palestinian towns, to then not knowing what it is that has been hit because of the censorship. You can imagine what it's like to be living here, because you're in the dark, and there's just nothing. You know that if something happens, that it's going to be very likely that you probably will sustain very serious injuries.
Yes, Diana. It's important that you mentioned the censorship of the videos or on the media of what is actually has been going in the Green Line. So my question is, why would the Israeli government impose censorship on the media and on videos that simply show what's actually happening on the ground? Why is there a censorship?
You know, I can't really answer that. I can say that they censor, you know, that one thing that people don't realize is that the government press office is actually a censorship office, and it's a censorship office from day one. This isn't just as a result of Israel's attack on Iran. It's been like this forever. And so a lot of it is that they don't want people to know what it is that has been hit. They claim this is all about security, but I think it's that they don't really want people to know what has been hit. I think another element of it is that I don't think they wanted people to see that much of what was targeted was actually military targets. It's not clear to me why these censorship rules exist, except to say that they just don't want us to see what it is that has been hit. And I think that they like this idea of keeping us always in the dark, so that they're the ones who can control the message.
I think that was my last question. Thank you so much, Diana, for all of your input and analysis.
Thank you. Thank you, Diana. It's been lovely chatting with you.
We begin today's show looking at the rise of Israeli settler violence against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. The family of 20-year-old American Sefola Musalat is demanding justice and for the U.S. government to lead an investigation into his killing by Israeli settlers. Musalat, known as Seif to his family and friends, was in the West Bank from Florida to visit his relatives in the village of Al-Masra Ash-Sharkiya, northeast of Ramallah. He was born and grew up in Port Charlotte, Florida, and worked at his father's ice cream and dessert shop, which they'd recently opened in Tampa. On Friday, Musalat and another Palestinian, 23-year-old Mohammed Al-Shalabi, were attacked by a group of Israeli settlers while they were in neighboring town of Sinjil, where their families own farmland, and an area Israeli settlers have recently repeatedly targeted with violent attacks, with Palestinians describing being terrorized as Israelis have seized agricultural land on a Palestinian farm. In response, residents of nearby villages have organized to protect the land. On Friday, when Seif joined them, Israeli settlers brutally beat him and fatally shot Al-Shalabi. Eyewitnesses said at least two of the settlers were armed with M16 assault rifles and wore army pants, and described how the settlers surrounded Seif and others, also attacking them with batons. Following news of the attack, Seif's cousin Diana read a statement from the family.
We are devastated that our beloved Sefola Musalat, nicknamed Seif, was brutally beaten to death in our family's land by illegal Israeli settlers who were attempting to steal it. Israeli settlers surrounded Seif for over 3 hours as paramedics attempted to reach him, but the mob of settlers blocked the ambulance and paramedics from providing life-saving aid. After the mob of Israeli settlers cleared, hours later, Seif's younger brother rushed to carry him to the ambulance. Seif was killed and died before reaching the hospital.
On Sunday, hundreds of Palestinians gathered for a funeral procession in the West Bank for Seif Musalat and Mohammed Al-Shalabi. Seif's father, Kamel, traveled from Florida to attend his son's funeral. Saif's family says they haven't heard from U.S. officials. In a statement to Al Jazeera Friday, the State Department said it, quote, has no higher priority than the safety and security of U.S. citizens overseas. We are aware of reports of the death of a U.S. citizen in the West Bank. When a U.S. citizen dies overseas, we stand ready to provide consular services, the U.S. State Department said. Haaretz reported there are currently no Israelis detained in connection with Saif's killing. He's at least the seventh U.S. citizen to be killed by Israeli soldiers or settlers since 2022, with advocates condemning the U.S.'s inaction and fighting for accountability, including in the killings of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, May 11th, 2022, fatally shot by Israeli soldiers while she reported on an Israeli raid outside the Jenin refugee camp. And Turkish-American activist Aysenur Ezgi Aygi, who was shot dead by Israeli forces while taking part in a weekly protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beita in 2024. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports Israeli violence has killed some 1,000 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since October 23. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Yaffa, Jonathan Pollack is a longtime anti-Zionist activist and co-founder of Anarchists Against the Wall. He was injured Friday by Israeli settlers in the West Bank town of Sinjil when protesting just before Saif was killed. And in the occupied West Bank, we're joined by Nizar Milbus, a distant relative, a close friend of Saifola Musalet's family. Nizar Milbus is in the village of Amasra Ash Sharkia, northeast of Ramallah. We thank you both for being with us. Jonathan, as I look at you, you have a black eye. Can you describe what happened that day leading up to the Israeli settlers beating Saif to death?
I can tell what I've witnessed, which is somewhat limited because I was attacked and detained very soon after everything began. Myself and another Palestinian, a young Palestinian man, were helping an older injured Palestinian man, evacuating him away from where settlers were attacking people. At some point, the settlers descended on us from above with batons and just beat us up. The young Palestinian man that was with me more than myself, and myself as well, as is very evident from the bruises on my face. It's important to note that there were Israeli soldiers there. They literally pried us from the settlers' hands while they attacked us. Well, we were on the floor and they were on top of us. Despite that, they've chosen to detain and arrest us and do nothing with the assailants, despite having seen everything and despite having been there. We were detained there for a long time before being taken to the police station. And what we saw at some point is that all the settlers who were present, which were at least two dozens, entered their cars all at once and drove in sight, like while the soldiers see them, drove into the village. None of the soldiers have thought of stopping them or arresting them or doing anything else to prevent the lynch that took place afterwards, in which Saifullah and Muhammad were killed. Later on that day, when we were already down the road, still detained, we at some point saw a convoy of at least a dozen settler cars filled with people passing after the lynch, passing by Israeli law enforcement, both like military border police, which is a paramilitary force of the Israeli police, and regular Israeli civilian police. None of them had dreamed of stopping these settlers who had just been involved in killing someone, at least some of them, and even asking for their IDs. People often talk about settlers, about Israeli settlers and extremist violence. It's important to me to convey the message that this is a red herring. This isn't an issue of some extremists, of outlaws acting outside the confines of Israeli society. The settlers and the military don't only work hand in hand, like it was evident from how our assault was treated and how the whole incident was treated. They are part and parcel of implementing the same policy of the Israeli government, of the Israeli regime, the policy of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the policy of employing as much violence as possible in order to remove Palestinians from their land. It was evident in the murder of Saif Allah and of Muhammad on Tuesday. It is evident in the ethnic cleansing of dozens and dozens of Palestinian communities from the West Bank since October 7th, 2023, and it is an extension of the genocide that Israel is perpetrating in the Gaza Strip. And the common denominator of all of these is that it is one policy employed by the Israeli regime, representative of Israeli public opinion, and that Israel is allowed to employ as much force as it wants, as much violence as it wants, in order to carry out these policies, in order to exterminate in the Gaza Strip and physically remove Palestinians in the West Bank from their lands.
And Jonathan, when you were held by the Israeli police, what happened? How long were you held, and how were you treated by them?
This isn't the question. The question isn't about me personally or how a specific policeman or specific policemen in plural treated me. What I'm interested in talking about is the systemic nature of what is happening. So what is interesting in this case is that I was arrested with another Palestinian. While I was released very quickly, the Palestinian man was only released from court today, released by court from jail today. And this is another example of Israeli apartheid, where I myself was processed and tried under the Israeli penal code, while my Palestinian comrade, the one who was arrested with me and under the exact same circumstances, suspected of the exact same things, assaulted like I was by the exact same settlers, the same settlers who later went on to kill Saif Allah and Muhammad. We were processed through two different legal systems, the Israeli penal code for myself and Israeli military law for my Palestinian comrade. So when we talk about how I was treated, the important question to ask is why I was treated differently from my Palestinian comrade. And what does that mean about the Israeli regime and the ability and need for it to be confronted not only from within, not only from Palestine, but also be forced into accountability from the outside? What support do Palestinians deserve, and how do we bring about a reality in which they are able to gain their liberation?
I'd like to bring in, if possible, Nizar Milbus as well. Nizar, can you talk about when you learned of the attack on friends and relatives of yours?
Well, let me give a little bit of context. We have been, this area has been an area where it's called the Botan. It's on the outskirts of the town. And many of the landowners are American citizens. And we've been trying to reach, as you're aware, you know, the settlers are taking over not only Area C, which, to give, you know, your viewers some context, Area C was an area that was allocated during the Oslo Accords, which was supposed to be part of a Palestinian state, but eventually the Israeli government allocated it, which a lot of the land is strategic land. It has some of high altitudes, very important security installations, and you know, a lot of fertile land, farmland, and so in the past, you know, I remember when I was living here in the 90s, when my parents brought us here to, you know, learn our culture and root us in the land, you know, they would build you know, communities in these areas that were, you know, quite a distance from our towns, but after the Oslo Accords, the areas A and B, which are supposed to be under, you know, that agreement, is supposed to be civilly and security-wise administered by the Palestinian Authority. So even under Israeli law, they're not even supposed to encroach anywhere near this area. We've been hearing over the past, since October 7th, that, you know, they've been taking lands and encroaching and destroying property as they move towards area A and B. But what really caught our eye is that we never expected, given that our town and the surrounding towns have a large majority of American citizens, residents that have American citizenship. Our town in particular, the inhabitants comprise of about 60% American citizens, and the land in this particular area where this attack has happened, that happened on Friday, is on the outskirts of the town. It's an area that is has beautiful scenery, very fertile. Many of the landowners, it's, you know, it's one of the last havens that Palestinians have left to enjoy their time, given that the fact that, you know, Palestinians are not allowed to go, you know, to enter so-called Israel proper. They can't go to the beach, they can't go to the springs, they can't visit the desert. So they're secluded in this area of the West Bank, where they're not allowed to go to the Area C, which is some of the most, you know, beautiful parts of the West Bank. And so this area, the Botan, it's one of the last havens that Palestinians have to go to, you know, get away from, you know, their daily life and the daily lives of living under occupation, checkpoints, daily raids. And so what really, you know, got the galvanized the community is that this particular area, which we never thought that they would attempt to, you know, come to, they started coming over there and burning, you know, vacation homes, tents, that the townspeople put up to go, you know, every, you know, Friday to go enjoy their time barbecue. And so this has been going on for several weeks. And so recently, you know, during the summer, a lot of the American citizens come to visit their property. So some of the townspeople had asked us to, you know, because the people here, as you know, echoing, you know, the other guests, the Palestinians here have zero rights. You know, they feel.
Nizar, we just have a minute, and I wanted to get to the issue of, in fact, Saif didn't die when he was being beaten by the Israeli settlers, but the fact that they wouldn't let the ambulance come. Can you talk about that for a minute? I was just watching CNN. The CNN journalists, they smashed the window of his vehicle as they went in the area. Can you talk about what happened to Saif at the very end? We just have a minute.
So what happened is you know, I was getting towards the end of what had occurred that led up to that. So We've been going the past every, you know, once or twice a week to reach the lands, and every week it's been different. The prior week we had went with journalists. We had the townspeople call on the American citizens to go to their lands and just peacefully go on the lands without, no one is armed. This particular time, some of the youth had ventured off into some of the areas, you know, because you have, you know, this is about around, you know, I believe 1,000 dunams of land. So some of the youth, including Saif and Muhammad, you know, as we were driving, you know, on the road, they kind of deviated and went, you know, to go to their part of the land.
Very quickly, about the ambulance.
The ambulance, actually, when we were going up, ambulances were coming down and they were being attacked. Their windshield was smashed. You know, they were given no deference to you know, ambulances, to the press. And Saif, unfortunately, when he had tried to attempt his part of the land, they got ambushed. A lot of times the settlers, they know the area pretty well. And it seems like they staged their, you know, they strategized their attacks. And, you know, he seemed to be alone with maybe another youth, and they got to him. I mean, he didn't attack them. He wasn't armed, and they just beat him. The autopsy shows head trauma to the back of the head and a couple of hits to the body.
Nizar, I want to thank you for being with us, and our condolences. Nizar Milbus, a Palestinian-American distant relative, close friend of Saif Olam Salat's family, and Jonathan Pollack, anti-Zionist activist, co-founder of Anarchists Against the Wall, injured on Friday, the day that Saif was killed by Israeli settlers in the West Bank town of Sinjil.
The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on United Nations Special Rapporteur for Palestine, Francesca Albanese, over her report naming dozens of companies she says are profiting from Israeli occupation and genocide in Gaza. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced the sanctions in a social media post Wednesday, stating, quote, Albanese's campaign of political and economic warfare against the United States and Israel will no longer be tolerated, Rubio wrote. Amnesty International blasted the sanctions as a, quote, shameless and transparent attack on the fundamental principles of international justice. Francesca Albanese will join us in a minute. The sanctions were filed after she gave a presentation last week to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva and called on states to impose an arms embargo and cut off trade and financial ties with Israel, which she alleged was, quote, responsible for one of the cruelest genocides in modern history.
If the genocide has not stopped, it's not just because there has always been an economy of the occupation. It's because the economy of the occupation has turned into an economy of genocide. And so there have been people and organizations that have profited from the violence, the killing, the maiming, the destruction in Gaza and in other parts of the occupied Palestinian territory, because it's not that the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are having the happiest time of their life as we speak. In the past 20 months, while the Israeli army and accompanied by settlers was devastating Palestinian lives and landscapes, the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange soared by 213%, amassing over $220 billion in market gains, including $76.8 billion US dollars in the past month alone. So clearly for some, genocide is profitable.
For more, we're joined by Francesca Albanese herself, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Her landmark report is headlined From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. Francesca, we last spoke to you in our New York City studio. You're now in the capital of Slovenia. You've just held a news conference. This news has just come out in the last day that the U.S. is going to sanction you, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Trump has already sanctioned top international criminal court officials like the ICC chief prosecutor, Karim Khan. The ICC has come out with an arrest warrant for both Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former Israeli defense minister. Can you respond to the sanctions against you and what they mean?
Hi, Amy. Hi, Narmin. Thank you for being for having me with you. Would I respond? It seems that this administration is quite allergic to justice, isn't it? I woke up this morning. I could take my shower. I could talk to my kids. I could meet the wonderful people of Slovenia, institutions and ordinary citizens alike without the sound of drones. Yes, I skipped breakfast, but I chose it. I was not starving. I'm not starving. And this is the situation of the people of Gaza. This is what we need to talk about, because what the U.S. is doing, I mean, people can make their own assessment of it, is distracting us, is trying to distract us from where our focus should be. What's happening to the Palestinian in what remains, the little that remains of their tormented land, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem.
And could you talk, Francesca, about the fact that this announcement came on while Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C., in fact, his third visit to the United States since Trump came into office in January?
Yeah, in fact, I should correct it. It's not that this administration is allergic to justice. It's attracted to injustice more than justice, because the ICC wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't belong to Washington, D.C. He belongs to The Hague or anywhere else where he can be prosecuted as the ICC has requested. Look, I'm more than, I mean, I know the United States is not a member to the Rome Statute, has imposed the sanctions on the ICC. And technically, the argument to impose the sanctions against me is that I cooperate with the ICC. Surely so. Like anyone who wants justice, the ICC is based on the Rome Statute. And I'm a proud Italian, happy that it was my country and the capital of my country to give the name to the statute of the International Criminal Law Court. That is, I mean, this is also the legacy of the of World War II and the Holocaust. Universal justice starts with that. So look at the paradox. But again, I'm more horrified that my own country, Italy, and Greece, and France, three member states of the Rome Statute, allowed ICC wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity Benjamin Netanyahu to fly with his airplane toward Washington D.C. over their souls, because this is unacceptable. They should have not given such a concession. He must be arrested.
So, Francesca, let's go to your report, the UN report from economy of occupation to economy of genocide. When we had you on last year in October, you were working on a report. The report had just come out on genocide as colonial erasure. You've also issued another report, Anatomy of a Genocide. So explain why and when you moved your focus to the economic beneficiaries of what's been happening in Gaza.
Yeah, look, I decided to investigate the private sector in February 2023 when I went to Norway. And for the first time, I saw what many had already been investigating and denouncing, the BDS movement, Don't Buy Into the Occupation, Profundo, Somo, Who Profits, and the fact that there were people making business in the, you know, in the system, within the system of the military occupation that is Israel was maintaining over the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, it really, as someone has said, it only a lawyer can take ages to realize the political economics of the occupation. But however, 2 years later, I was into the investigation of all the companies that I had started to collect information about 2 years later, because in the middle it was a genocide. I needed to make sense of the military assault that since October 2023, Israel had launched against the Gaza Strip, while also accelerating the annexation and the ethnic cleansing in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. And as I collected together with my team and all the actors that contributed, the lawyers, investigative journalists, and others who contributed to the acquisition of information that I verified, to the setup of a database of 1,000 entities, of which I just collected those eminent cases that help illustrate the system. So, Amy, my report is not to be read as a duplicate of the database that that the UN has set up years ago and is updating. It's illustrative of a system, an economy of occupation. Israel would have not been able to maintain the military occupation without the support, the means, the weapons, the machinery, the technology, the legitimacy that has come, including from the pension funds, including the Norwegian pension funds, the legitimacy of the universities, and so on and so forth.
I want to go to last month, Norway's largest pension fund, what you're referring to, known as KLP, announced it would no longer invest in two companies that sell equipment to the Israeli military. The pension fund managing the savings of about 900,000 Norwegian municipal workers. Democracy Now! Spoke to Kiran Aziz, head of responsible investments at KLP, about how they came to the decision.
KLP, as Norway's largest pension company, has decided to exclude companies Oshkosh Corporation and ThyssenKrupp due to their sales of weapons to the Israeli military. KLP learned from a report conducted by the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights that several companies were supplying weapons or equipment to the Israeli Defense Force, and these weapons are being used in Gaza. On the basis of this information, KLP has done a thorough assessment of the companies, but also engaged in dialogue with them in order to understand what kind of due diligence they have performed. And like in all other situations, companies have an independent duty to exercise due diligence in order to avoid complicity. But based on our assessment, these companies have failed to demonstrate any due diligence at all. And these companies are also having a long-standing collaboration with the IDF, and weapons delivered have continued after the outbreak of the war in Gaza. Exclusion is an important tool for us to reduce KLP's association with unacceptable conditions that are ongoing or likely to occur in the future. But exclusion is also a way to hold companies accountable, because we all need to respect international law and humanitarian law.
So that was Kiran Aziz, head of responsible investments at KLP. Meanwhile, one of the world's largest shipping companies, Maersk, has recently announced it'll divest from companies linked to illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank following a sustained pressure campaign called Mask Off Maersk that was led by Palestinian youth movement. This is Nadia Tanous, international coordinator of the campaign.
This is a huge win for the movement. Maersk is the Danish logistics giant. They're one of the largest companies on the planet, and they are the first logistics company ever to cease transportation of settlement goods, all settlement products, into the Israeli settlements and out of the Israeli settlements. I think that this is a large step, a first step to isolating the Israeli settlements from the global economy, which decreases their ability to terrorize the Palestinians and people, to annex more land, and to continue to break international law. We also were able to ascertain this win not because we demanded divestment from the settlements, but because we lifted the political ceiling and we demanded a people's arms embargo. Maersk is still complicit in the transshipment of arms and weapons components of military cargo to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. They're endemic to the supply chain of the F-35 bomber, which is one of the most expensive and deadliest weapons on the market. And that's why Maersk This news came the same week as the Francesca Albanese report, which details at length multiple corporations that are complicit in the genocide of the Palestinian people and profiting off of that genocide. Maersk is one of them.
So that's Nadia Tanous of the Palestine Youth Movement. Francesca Albanese, as you listen to both women from Norway and taking on the Danish company Maersk, if you can talk about the other companies that you've been targeting and if these U.S. sanctions are going to change your approach.
You know, let me share an anecdote because this is really telling. I've been engaging with a major newspaper who refused to report on my report because it was not accurate. And I mean, it was not accurate, not solid enough because I had used this as a source. This particular report, the work that this youth movement has done. And you see the condescending attitude of the West and the saviorism that we carry. The youth movement is associated with lack of expertise. Oof, I'm so glad that the world is changing and we are in the hands with this young generation. We are in better hands. What I want to reflect on as listening, as answering your question, Amy, is something that Nadia said, meaning it's the endemic, that there are certain services that companies are providing that go to something that is endemic to the illegal occupation, to the apartheid structure that Israel has maintained over the years, over the Palestinians, and now has even turned genocidal. And it's the fact that while people have concentrated their attention without any result on settlements, settlements are clearly at the heart of the problem, but they're entrenched in the Israeli system. The universities have been legitimizing and giving even means, they've been transferring funds and endowments to the Israeli occupation and very ideology of erasure of the Palestinian people. This is why I say there is no neutral sector when it comes to Israel as the state, which has maintained for 57 years an unlawful occupation. And when you look at the water sector, the electricity, for example, there is one grid, there is one way of extracting Palestinian resources and then depriving the Palestinians of them. This is why today I do not call for sanctions on individuals and on companies producing in the settlements. This is the past century. This is the old Bible. This is what we have to do today, is to act like intelligent people and realize that if Israel is accused in different international proceedings of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even genocide, it's Israel as a state which is to face the consequences, including sanctions and cutting economic ties with Israel as a state.
If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.